Hello, and welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmush, and this is our second episode in our series with Nick Greenfield, founder and board chair of One Codex. As always, I recommend listening to the first episode if you haven't already to get a sense of the early days of Nick's company, since today we're going to talk about how One Codex really came to be. All right, welcome back, Nick. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Dave.
So, we made brief mention of it last time, but you started One Codex in 2014. I stalked your LinkedIn a little bit. That was not very long after you received your master's degree. So I would say not very long anyway. Maybe you thought that was
years.
A long time.
Yeah, it felt like a long time in my 20s. It feels like less of a long time now.
Sure, but 5 years going from degree to company founder. Maybe it's still just me, but it seems like it's short in this scheme of things. But I sense that there is a deeper story there, not only because of it being a five-year span in your 20s to create a company, but also because your degrees were in environmental studies and international relations.
Yeah. So the yes, definitely not. I'm not a microbiologist now or by training. So the backstory for One Codex and how it got started is a little bit circuitous, as I think many are. But my undergraduate and master's work was in quantitative social science. So did do a little bit of programming, a little bit of statistics.
Wasn't a lot of data science.
Like a book only nerd, and worked in strategy consulting and actually kind of geostrategy work for a couple of years out of college. And then I was in the Bay Area and it made sense to try my hand at this whole software engineering thing. And I had a low risk opportunity to go join a company that some ex-colleagues actually worked at. It was a Y Combinator company. They'd just been acquired actually. So it was like low risk. They said to me, come help us solve a bunch of fraud problems. If you can't do it, that's okay. We'll just treat you like an ex-consultant and make you make slides. So my downside risk was I'm going to have to make slides for more years of my life. The upside was, you know, opportunity to kind of transition, build a technical skill set, et cetera. So I did that for about a year. And One Codex was actually kind of started on the side during that time in 2013.
Okay.
So the original One Codex was, as some good adventures and some bad adventures. My now wife's best friend from elementary school is now husband. We got drinks New Year's Eve of 2012. And he brought to my attention this contest that an organization within the Defense Department called DITRA, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, which does a variety of things. But one of the things that they do is they kind of act as the CDC for the Defense Department. So they think about infectious disease. They think about wounds and the nasty things that can infect wounds, especially in kind of austere overseas environments, et cetera. And they were running this contest that they started in 2013 with some long name that I can't actually remember the exact name. I should have prepped for this a little bit better. But basically, they're running this contest for better metagenomics algorithms. And my friend, also named Nick with no German Nick, so no C, pitched me on, you know, you should help write some software for this. He was training for his MD PhD at University of Washington. I'll help with the genomics side. His work was focused on autism, not microbiology, but like, you know, these are minor details. And like, this will be great. And we'll win this prize and do a great job. So over the course of 2013, we spent all this time working on algorithms actually for metagenomic classification. And this was before the wave of the kind of newer CAMR-based methods, you know, Kraken, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Dave, and for maybe some of the really nerdy listeners are familiar with, but a tool for metagenomics analysis that's become very popular over the last 10 years. That was actually developed during the same contest. So Derek Wood, the original kind of author of that, was also a participant in this contest, also didn't win just like us. We spent all of 2013 working on like nights and weekends on how do we build a better metagenomics database? How do we build a better metagenomics classifier? But we got second place, which had no prize.
Do you remember who you lost to?
I was a scientist out of the University of, I'm going to butcher this, Tübingen in Germany, and I think a couple of collaborators in Singapore.
Interesting that they were in the Dittrich contest.
This was this era of like a lot of government agencies were trying, experimenting with like open innovation and how do we get wisdom of the crowds and, you know, all of that. Anyways, so we spent all this time. We built something that we thought was really cool. We got $0 in second place and really not much for it. And we looked around and I think at the time we thought, oh, cool, we've built this algorithm. It's faster. It's more memory efficient. I mean, we were very focused on like the elegance of this algorithmic approach. There were some novel data structures. And I said, I think there's something here that we should do. Like, I think we should start a company. And my friend said, like, I'm finishing my PhD. Like, then I have to go back to med school for 2 years. Like, I don't think we can pull this off. And I was like, I think we should do it. And he's like, you know, if we could do Y Combinator, I think that'd be cool. And I was like, all right, like, let's apply. So we build this little prototype. We apply to YC. We get in. And that was really like how the company got started. And the prototype was so crude and bad. Like, I found a slide. I don't know if I even have any like real screenshots, but I found a slide somehow that had a screenshot of it. It was really, really hacky. And we were like so cheap. And, you know, we ran it on a single Hetzner server that we rented out of Germany because it was like the lowest cost place we could find a server with a lot of RAM. And, you know, it was a little grayscaley website where you could drag and drop 5 megabytes of a FASTQ file into it because we were like too cheap to like want to store. We were doing everything within the HTTP request lifecycle. So like your web browser, we had to process it while your web browser sent the data so we could send you back a result live. We weren't doing any like offline batching or storage or anything. So it was this very crude prototype. And we thought everyone was going to be like, oh, cool. Like, this is a really accurate classifier, or this is so fast relative to the existing tools, which were mostly alignment based and a lot slower. And, you know, like one or two people had nice comments on that. But the vast majority of people, we put it out, and a bunch of pretty accomplished scientists found it on Twitter and elsewhere. And the main feedback was like, oh my God, this is so easy to use. And we looked at this and we're like, this is this crummy prototype. Like, it's ugly. Like this is not, we've not exceeded our own expectations on the beauty or ease of use of this prototype. But they were like, but it's so much easier to use than these command line tools. And so that was like the genesis of One Codex, was that realization that there was, again, this ease of use gap and how it all got started. So, you know, I got dragged in through this contest by accident. That was my crash course in what metagenomics even was. And really came at it from that kind of quantitative social science, data science background, some software engineering into, yeah, applied microbiology software tools.
I want to ask how you built your first metagenomic database, because that is always, you know, a main feature of any of these tools. And I'm sure that's interesting. Maybe it's only interesting to me, but I'm sure it's interesting. But first, like, necessity is the mother of invention, they say, right? And I'm wondering if you were, you know, RAM limited because your server was in Germany and you didn't have a lot of money to go around and you're trying to get things done quickly in that HTTP window, how much has that, you know, algorithm design from years ago benefited now as file sizes bloom? You know, NextSeqs are putting out easily 20 gigabyte FASTQ files. That's when they're compressed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And a lot of the data, I would say the vast majority of data that we looked at in the early days was MySeq data, right? So, you know, I don't have the Illumina spec sheets in front of me, but an order of magnitude less than what a NextSeq generates, two orders of magnitude less than what a NovaSeq generates. So like, yeah, it felt data rich at the time, but like it was in today's terms, these were comparatively like data poor systems in terms of what they generated. It was just very different, you know, like again, at the time in 2013, 14, all of the main algorithms were, you know, it's not fair to say that BLAST is an ON or linear time algorithm because it's not quite, it has like a seed and extend approach. But basically, if you have a really big database with BLAST, it takes a lot longer than a really small database with BLAST to a rough approximation. And when we first came to the problem, we said, this seems a little bit crazy that things are not constant time relative to the reference database sizes. So all the early work was focused on extrapolation on our part of like, how many reference genomes are going to be available? How much comparative data might you want to have in your comparison set? It seemed inarguable that that was growing super linearly, exponentially or not, maybe, but like the line was not going up at a steady rate. It was very much up and to the right hockey stick. That was kind of like the founding algorithmic insight was we've got to do things in a way that's constant time as data set sizes grow, both on the input size, but also on the reference size. And I think that's a lot of people had that insight and a lot of new mm-hmm. tools were written over the last 10 years. But I would say that's still useful. Like things are still faster. We're still using some of the same data structures today to be a little bit more efficient with RAM and to be able to put more data on a single server so that you can do everything in RAM because that's so much faster than working off disk. A lot of the same principles I think still apply. And that's because the data picture is still the same. It's just a couple clicks bigger.
I do think that's an interesting distinction, like philosophically from how a microbiologist might approach this versus how a data and software.
I didn't know anything about microbiology. So I was just like, it seems like everything takes a linear amount of like, I process E. coli reference 1 and then E. coli reference 2 and then E. coli reference 3. That seems inefficient. Like that was the first kind of insight that I had. And we were really focused on trying to solve that problem. To your point about the reference databases, obviously there are a lot of problems around data quality and curation and whatnot. I think in the early days, we had a little bit of a belief of some of the data curation problems go away if you can just get your hand on more data. Like some the data curation numbers. Problem is very acute if you're picking one of 100 things to use as a reference, because if you pick the wrong one, it's really bad. But if you can pick all 100, maybe it's, you'd love to have perfect data, but maybe it's a little bit more tolerable. I think my perspective on that has shifted a little bit. And now I would say that we've invested a lot over time, and obviously ATCC has invested a tremendous amount thinking about how to generate really kind of traceable, high quality data where the thing is the thing that it's labeled to be as opposed to something else. It's not
a harder problem than
it's not a mixture. It's not contaminated. It doesn't have kind of any of these data processing artifacts. I'm kind of a big believer in you need a lot of data and you need good data. There's some balance of those today. But I think in 2014, that was a little less, there was more leverage from just using all the available data.
Yeah, the other half of that is when your data is of higher quality, you don't, like you said, there's a point where you need more data and you need higher quality data. But if the quality comes first.
It depends on the problem that you're solving. And again, I think like the original problem that we were solving was very much one of taxonomic identification. That in practice meant what species are present. It's not today a particularly hard problem. Like that's not the hardest sub problem here. It's much harder to say like, what are the strains? What's the mixture of strains?
Mm-hmm.
How well represented is the mixture of strains in your sample relative to what's in a reference database? So like what's the unknown strain quotient? Like these are still, I think, hard open problems in a lot of ways. And there's some, different nuances about how much data you need and how good it needs to be if you're really focused on that problem versus the kind of species bucket calling problem. Same thing applies for functional profiling and other use cases too. But yeah, data quality is important, I guess. Like data quality remains very important. having a lot of data, I think, is also very useful, and the infrastructure and algorithms to be able to use a lot of data let you solve problems in a little bit of a different way than how you might naively without it.
Mm-hmm. What is kind of shifting gears here, but just something that you've learned in this whole 10-year span that you hope that anyone else who was in your situation or is in a similar situation would also have as a takeaway? Some grand lesson that you hope others have?
Well, I think going back to what we talked about on the last session, we started too early. And I think with the wrong disposition, that can feel very defeating and can kill a company, or it doesn't have to be a company, it can kill a project of any kind, right? Because things are harder than they need to be. The feedback that you get is less praiseful, let's say.
That's a nice way to put it.
And yeah, and I think that can be demoralizing. And so I think like one of the main things that I learned, and perhaps wrongly, and I'll learn this lesson, a different lesson later in life, is that I think if you have the right signal and you have conviction, and your conviction is well-founded in feedback from the world, not I think you can delude yourself and you can get in your own bubble and have conviction about bad ideas too. But if you're getting enough signal, where you have a lot of conviction that you should keep going, figuring out the right structure and making sure you can keep going and you can ride through that, is, I think, in many cases, the difference between things working out and things not working out. So to me, like, it feels corny to say like resilience, but like the startup journey, at least, I think, is a school of hard knocks. And like being confident in your belief in what you're doing and insulating yourself from some of those knocks, I think, is a prerequisite really to success. I think like even the most glorified stories, like, the Airbnbs of the world, well, they've made this good marketing, but like they did sell cereal for a little while, and they sold cereal not because it was cool marketing to sell cereal, but because like they thought we really need to pay some bills selling some cereal, right? Maybe it was marketing, but you get the idea. Like the people were sleeping on their floor in their apartment,
right?
Because they needed it to work, not because that was good marketing.
Well, it's always important to, recognize the difficulties with the business. Push through it. I appreciate you saying also to not insulate yourself from it either, but not get bogged down in it. And I guess to an extent, there's a do what you have to do until it works.
Yeah, exactly.
So Nick, we mentioned earlier, obviously your position, your role at One Codex has changed. That was around 2021. I imagine that was something of a significant moment in your career as well. So what happened there?
Sure. Yeah. So there's a little bit of a convoluted story. So my role today, as we discussed, is kind of in this executive chair role at One Codex. There was a brief period through really 2023, or the first 9 months of 2023, where I actually wasn't involved with One Codex. And so in 2021, we were in the wonderful position of actually getting an offer to buy the company. And we sold the company. We were acquired by Invitae Corporation, which at the time was, I don't know if they were the largest by volume, but one of the largest 3, 4, 5 clinical genetic testing companies, really specialized in inherited kind of germline mutation analysis, a lot for oncology applications, but a whole range of different things, NIPT, all kinds of different clinical genetic testing. And the thesis for that was pretty simple. It was, we were a really good dry side operation. We knew a lot about microbiology. Invitae didn't do anything in microbiology yet. They were interested in doing more, both for infectious disease, but also thinking about microbiome as biomarkers of other disease, and thinking about microbiome biomarker panels. And, it made a lot of sense to use their lab assets and their lab expertise, and also their expertise thinking about clinical test development and navigating the LDT landscape, and to kind of power that with what we've been doing on the data analysis and kind of the computational biology side. So made a lot of sense. We worked with them as a strategic partner for a year or two before the acquisition, sold the company in February 2021, went through an integration, and kind of unfortunately, at Invitae, like things were not as, we had planned to build a microbiology lab, for example, which was quite critical in doing some of this product development. And that did not get off particularly quickly. And there were funding challenges and things of this kind. And, basically over the course of 21 and into 22, it became pretty clear that Invitae was a little overextended in terms of its portfolio, and couldn't make some of these additional investments. So I actually left Invitae, where I was kind of the head of microbiome at the end of 21, and went over to work with what had been One Codex partner, Ginkgo Bioworks, leading product and tech for their biosecurity division, which is primarily COVID testing at the time, now much more of a genomic surveillance player. And, you know, things, the team was still in place. They loved working together. Things were going okay, but not great at Invitae, I think is a fair way of characterizing it. And then Invitae announced in the summer of 22 that they were going to have to make some strategic divestments. And they had a bunch of businesses that they'd acquired. The largest was Archer Diagnostics. We were not the largest by any means. But, you know, as a company, they needed to focus on their core business, speculative infectious disease diagnostics or microbiome biomarker assays that were still pretty early, were not that. And so we actually ended up in a position where we were able to kind of work with Invitae and negotiate spinning OneCodex back out. And so it became a independent company again in the fall of 23 in September of, excuse me, 22 in the fall, September 22. And that's kind of when I moved into that. I was still working at Ginkgo while this was all going on. And so that's when I moved into that kind of like non-employee role. And we elevated the, who'd been kind of my right hand man and the product manager at OneCodex, this guy, Chris Smith, wonderful guy, to be the CEO, general manager of the business, knows the thing like with the back of his hand. And he's really been running it day to day since late 22. And then I've been much more in this supporting role, though a little bit more active just as I've had more time after leaving Ginkgo last year.
Wow. You know, I was around, you know, we were working together through the partnership. It was actually handled really smoothly, all things good. Considered.
It was a little bumpy on the inside.
Yeah, it was just a little hush-hush as far as what the overall story was. And for the life of me, it does not feel like it happened two, three years ago.
Yeah, everything was so distorted by COVID, too. So,
right.
You know, we thought, the timing was very bad. We tried to do a deal with Invitae before COVID. And one of the early things we talked about was, wouldn't it be really neat if we started sequencing all the saliva samples coming into Invitae's lab from all around the world for novel viruses? Just like looking for stuff. We had that conversation in fall of 2019. Really earlier than that. But like we had a serious conversation about it in fall of 2019. And then COVID happened and that derailed some things. And ultimately, we still did do a deal with Invitae and had the acquisition happen in, you know, 15 months later in February of 21. Yeah, it was a little bit of that COVID time warp. Like it didn't feel, everyone was on screens all the time. You know, finally we got to meet some people in person, but we did this deal like virtually. It was a very strange time to do something like that in 2020 and 2021. And then it was a little bit shorter lived than I think everyone had expected. And it's worked out. You know, the team, there were 15 folks at Invitae and 13 folks wanted to spin out and do this again. I think that's a testament to how much they like working together and kind of everyone feeling, again, to that question of conviction and resilience, like really good about what we built. But there were some hiccups and it wasn't clear that it was going to work out and we were going to be able to kind of spin it back out of Invitae. So, you know, that there's some anxiety over the summer and early fall of 22, I'll say. My daughter was born in September of 22. So like, there's a lot going on. There was a lot going on. So yeah, I hope you're
no doubt, two
out of the loop, but that it was bumpy.
No, all absolutely fine. It all worked out in the end. And I do think you unintentionally answered your question from earlier. Is it better to be early or late to a business opportunity? Because had you started swabbing saliva samples at Invitae a year earlier, things might have turned out real different.
Well, I don't want to say that, like, it would have been very interesting. Let's put it that way. I don't know that, like, the interventional capacity, there would have been any different at all. But, yeah, I think...
I'm talking from a business capacity. You wouldn't have stopped a pandemic necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. It was still pretty obvious that infectious disease was pretty interesting in 2020 and 2021 and infectious disease sequencing and, you know, arguably the single largest deployment of infectious disease sequencing is COVID, you know, viral variant characterization. Right. And yet still like that wasn't It was still hard to justify that as like a new product area and focus for Invitae. And I think in general, unfortunately, like we had a very large global pandemic and still the spending on biosurveillance and resilience at the national level, not where you'd like to see it. I think it's fair to say, you know, it's we perhaps have not learned all of our lessons from 2020.
All right. Well, I think that's going to about bring us on time for this one. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
All right. Thanks again, Dave.
In 2012, a couple of guys over drinks decide that they have no experience in metagenomics, but have a shot at winning a contest sponsored by the Department of Defense in precisely that field. They lost, but built a foothold that started a rough service and developed into an increasingly robust platform focused on the user experience as much as the analytics. Nick says he started a bit too early, but I don't think the level of success OneCodex has achieved would agree. We've got one more episode coming next week about where Nick and OneCodex will go from here.